As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome back to The Ruck. We've got Olympic winners with us this week. We have Currie Cup winners with us. And we've got the 1983 Dorking Under 16 tennis champion. We've also got Alex Lowe, man of the match and all-round hero in the Rugby Writers' slaughter of the RFU in our annual cricket match. So once again, The Ruck is brought to you by an elite cast of champions. I'm Owen Slott, he of the Dorking Tennis Triumph, well remembered. On an arguably more stratospheric level of achievement, our Olympic champion is Ben Ryan, our only podcaster ever to have had his face on a Fijian banknote. Ben coached Fiji to their Olympic gold at the Rio Olympics, a wonderful story which is now for me the best sports book of the year. 7-7, the beautiful chaos of Fiji's Olympic dream. Highly, highly recommended. Ben, great to have you here.
Great to be here. That was a nice intro. Thank you, Owen.
Well, I worked on it for you.
Yeah,
you
know, no, that's lovely.
And all that. Big first time welcome to Nick Easter, he of 54 England caps. But now, really interesting, back in the UK from his position on the coaching staff of the Natal Sharks in Durban, who he has just helped to lead to victory in the Currie Cup. Nick, great to have you here.
Thank you very much.
Start by talking us through what that was like, the Currie Cup, the final. We sort of see it on a TV a bit here, but I've never been. Have you been to one, Alex?
No.
Probably not as strong as it used to be, you know, back in the sort of apartheid times and just out of isolation. But they changed the format this year. Much shorter, much more of a sprint sort of format. So every game mattered. And it was great to be a part of, you know, understanding the sort of philosophy down there where they, you know, prioritise their training and their coaching, how they train, and actually what it means to them, because it is an age-old competition. You know, I think it's been going since 1891 or something like that. And they hadn't won it for 5 years, and they were under a bit of pressure to do the business. And it's always sweet when you win in someone else's backyard. And so it was down in Cape Town, which was painted black and white for about two nights afterwards. So it was pretty epic, and it was great to be a part of.
So you did that for a short stint then, but are we allowed to talk about what's happening next?
Yeah, at the moment I'm back for a couple of months. My wife's expecting our first in just under 2 weeks, so I did promise her, because she didn't come out with me.
Yeah,
she was too busy with work. She came out for, you know, 10 days to... for a little bit of obviously R&R, but too busy with work, so I've obviously got to do the dutiful husband thing. And so for the last month, building the nursery, all that sort of stuff, making sure she's all right, cooking.
It must be epic, yeah.
Oh yeah, it's great fun. So I said that I'd promise to do that. And meanwhile, when I was back over there, you know, we got on really well, and they want me to be back there for Super Rugby. At the moment, just sort of finalising, you know, what's going on, and I think it's just be a great experience.
So you'll have a whole season of Super Rugby coaching ahead of you, by the looks of things.
Yeah, you know, if all goes well, I think this week's obviously a big week in terms of, you know, where we go with that. And, you know, it's a great opportunity, you know, life experience. I think that's what it's about as well, but also from a career perspective. And to continue to work, you know, like I did for 3 months when I was out there. And a sign of them being really good to me is, look, their pre-season's already started. Yeah, it started sort of, this is their third week they're in. And when it was muted about a couple of months ago, I said, well, I can tell you something, I'm going to be at home, you know, doing fatherly duties and husband duties for a couple of months over Christmas and New Year. So, look, that's absolutely fine. You come mid-January, end of January, boys know what you're around. You know, we can still Skype and FaceTime.
And what's been your role there? Or what will be your role there?
I was doing the forwards and breakdown.
Right.
But it's quite interactive. You know, it's much more of a holistic approach as opposed to sort of compartmentalising. You know, that's what you do. Everyone sort of has you're in charge of your own aspect, clearly, but everyone has a sort of say, and it's all joined up.
And you've obviously seen a bit of those Dupreer brothers who've appeared at Sale now.
Sale, yeah.
Rate 'em?
Yeah, yeah, very good players. I'm looking forward to seeing how they're going. It wasn't a great spectacle yesterday, to be perfectly honest.
That's the Bar Sale game,
yeah,
which looked
right.
like it might be the first ever nil all Premiership it game in history,
it?
I think.
It was a proper turkey.
Yeah, 7-0. So, Ben, just hearing what Nick's doing in terms of a young coach, he's done... Did a season, two seasons of coaching at Harlequins.
Two
seasons at Harlequins, and now he's uploading all this South African experience. That you presumably Brilliant. Think that's a great thing to
yeah,
do, don't you?
I think that's an awesome plan for Nick. And just that, you know, we need more British coaches going overseas and getting not just IP and experiences and tasting different things, being different environments, just getting more bandwidth, you know, and then hopefully at some point returning back to these shores and putting it back into the domestic game. But yeah, no, it's, you know, New Zealand have been doing it for decades and we're just so far behind all of that. And we just, you know, I think occasionally, like, English coaches don't necessarily get the raps they should, so they don't go overseas because they're not offered jobs. But I think that's starting to turn a little bit, you know, and I guess the success of some of the domestic coaches, you're seeing how well they're going overseas, and see like Stuart doing well. I know it's only just about overseas, but he's still done a good job there. Joe Wesley's over in France at the moment. A couple of others over there. But
what happened
still,
to Rory Teagot in France? Because he got a head coach job, didn't he?
He did.
Didn't work very well.
No, it didn't. I mean, like, massive pressure down in Bordeaux to get results quickly, and it didn't work out for him there. So I think he's returned, and then Joe stepped up, from what I gather. You know, I work. And I'm a consultant for the French Federation, so you know, I hear what's
Sorry,
going on.
I should have known that.
You know,
Ben's a consultant in blinking every part of sport all over the world, so of course you're a consultant there.
So I sort of know what's happening at top 14 level and where they move around and everything.
But there are a few English coaches in top 14 now.
Joe Allab's taking a head coach position next season.
Yeah, and he's got a really good rep over in France as well. I mean, some settle in well, can speak the language quickly, can assimilate to the culture, and understand what's going on. And then, top 14 is a really interesting league. You know, the demands of winning at home, the demands of the owners, and then the bizarre way it works out on away games, and the S&C, the conditioning's there, very different to the Premiership. For a young coach going over there, I mean, you've got a lot to deal with there, and a lot of balls in the air. You've got to manage, lead and coach. And so, again, it's another really good league to go over to if
it's
you're
interesting,
you know,
that,
English
the,
coach.
The experience of English players in France, Alex, I will find it confusing because quite often you hear, kind of, I think what you're suggesting, that in certain areas, S&C in particular, they don't seem to be on the same page almost. And then you see some players who are so passionately proud of what they see there, what they've learnt there. I mean, Chris Ashton only did a season there, but he came back sort of singing the praises of his experience, didn't he?
Yeah, and I think that underlines why Eddie Jones is a big advocate of players and coaches. I mean, players can't go abroad because of the RFU rules. If you go away, you don't play for England. But coaches are different. And Eddie Jones, from the day he arrived, has been advocating coaches going abroad. And I went to see Dean Ryan a few weeks ago, and one of his roles is coach development. And he used you, Nick, as an example, actually, of how no coach is going to turn down an opportunity to go from playing at Quinns to coaching at Quinns. But he was saying that one of the reasons they're trying to get Premiership coaches into like an England setup, England 20 setup, is because it's a breadth of experience that you need, and you can't. You almost, and Eddie talks about it a lot. You need, sometimes you need to fail to improve. How do you guys see that coach development structure in England? Because you've gone abroad, Nick, and you know, Ben, you had totally different experiences, and that one in Fiji. Is it set up to assist young coaches, and because your experiences in South Africa are presumably really broad.
And Dean Ryan's been really good, you know, since left Quinns in the summer. You know, he's been keeping in touch, asking about experiences that I'm, you know, in the process of doing my level four as well, which I set up and got my mentor there. I'm actually meeting him on Wednesday to go through things. I think that's in its embryonic stage as far as the RFU, and you know, We know how the structure works. There's RFU and clubs, you know, it's very, very different. But they are actually looking out for young coaches and, you know, looking to develop them, looking to bring them through as, you know, wherever they want to go, as head coaches, DORs. But generally, in fact, they want them to actually be at English clubs. So it's not a case of developing you to be as good a coach as you can and then, you know, you bugger around the other side of the world. It's actually to bring you back into the English game.
But that's how the Kiwis work, isn't it? Go away, improve, learn, come back, and then
then they don't let any of us go down there.
But with Harlequin, just suppose that isn't that supposed to be the system? You should be going down there.
Yeah, but I think it's still going to be very, very difficult. I mean, I'm not sure how that agreement works out. I think it's over a multitude of areas. Young players coming over. I mean, I don't mind players going over there, you know, sending guys, young academy guys, getting a bit of experience in ITM Cup or club rugby over there, whatever it might be. And I think similarly, you know, there's a pathway. You know, I was out with a lot of the Quinns lads on Saturday, and they were looking at an under-21 player from New Zealand, I think, coming over and getting a bit of experience or maybe possibly signing him.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they have a pecking order over there, and, you know, if you're sort of third or fourth down there, it's time to cash in your chips sometimes instead of trying to, you know, live the All Black dream that's never going to arrive.
Ben, from what you've seen, sort of lots of different coaching structures and pathways, who in rugby, who does it best, and where do you think England is in that perspective? Because I get the impression that we do identify and develop quite a few young coaches, but certainly getting them to jump from being assistants to DORs. I mean, the amount of DORs that a club does badly, DOR comes in from New Zealand, it almost seems sort of de rigueur now, doesn't it? I mean, how do you sort of view all that?
I'm not as positive perhaps about the RFU's strategic planning around coaches. I just don't think they are targeting the young coaches as much as maybe they did. You think of, like, I remember Kevin Bowring, you know, when he was involved, and, you know, he targeted, like, I remember, you know, I was going up through Championship, Mark Mapletoft was coming through academy at Saracens, you know, and very early on for the two of us, Kevin kind of put him under his wing and started helping to develop us and then targeting opportunities at the RFU. I don't know who does that anymore, because it seems to be a little bit of a hole. And you know, and for me, it's a big alarm bell when coaches with IP like John Fletcher and Pete Walton and Russell Earnshaw get removed or move on.
Yeah, that's a good point. So the coaches you just mentioned have been running the England under-18s for a long period, and they've been hugely highly rated by the players who've come through, haven't they? And in the summer, they all just got the flick.
They did, and like, there's nothing wrong with. We're saying as a coach, that's your speciality, age group rugby, develop players, bring them through. I mean, if you look in other sports like football or collegiate basketball, you know, coaches, that's their career. You know, they understand how to work with 16 to 24 year olds or whatever, and they develop them through. New Zealand's more joined up thinking. You know, the player part, the coach pathways are far more straightforward. It's a smaller base. There's less coaches. There's less players. So it's a bit easier to identify. I think most of the really good work on coaching pathways is coming through at the better Premiership clubs. So let's take Exeter, for example. I mean, they got some really good ex-players, guys they've brought back in that are coming through coaching pathways, like Ali Hefa, for example, Ricky Pello, as well as the ones at the top.
So it's club-led rather than RFU-led, you think?
I think that's where there's more stuff going on at the moment. Because if they say it's integrated, so why does it stop at international level where Eddie's got a staff full of overseas coaches?
And Eddie's remit when he got the job was to bring through young English coaches.
Hey, there's English coaches there that could be filling the roles of you know, and that's nothing against people like Scott but, you know, I could name four or five guys in English rugby.
But isn't the answer to that question, why has Eddie not brought any in? Because Eddie's Eddie, and he wants to promote who he knows and what he likes.
Yeah, so then the RFU have got to admit they haven't got a seamless coaching pathway, and they haven't got because if it stops at first team level, and then everyone gets on with things below that, I don't know if that really makes sense. It's a bit like Man City saying, "Look, we're just having a first 11. That's what we're doing. We don't really care about what's coming through academy. We've got no pathway because that drives style, that drives talent ID, that drives the type of coach you want, the environment you want to create. If you suddenly got kind of two silos, effectively them and us, that you know, we seem to have gone backwards a little bit. I remember when Brian Ashton was involved and Clive, and they had like National Academy coaches that were really like seeing, you know, so Brian would have seen Sips coming through the system and earmarked him, got him involved. It would have been a bit more of a pathway.
As a young coach, so I'm presuming, guessing that at some point you would aspire to be a DOR, or how does that pathway look to you? Does it look confusing? Because, as I say, a head coach gets sacked these days, a DOR gets sacked, and it seems to be the knee-jerk reaction to look abroad for a replacement.
Yeah, but that's always been the case, isn't it, over here? Yeah, if they speak with a bit of a different accent, let's bring them over. I remember my second season at Oral. My second professional season was at Oral. We got Ross Reynolds over. You know, an ex-Australian guy there. You know, it was the fashionable thing to do back then as well. As I say, you know, Ben's been a part and keeping an eye on what the RFU have been doing, and sort of brings back these sort of historical references. My first experience has been, you know, since what happened in the summer. And they've been very, very positive with me. And maybe it's something they're trying to restructure or relook at what we prioritise. And, you know, that might be why, unfortunately, people lost their jobs and everything. But at the moment, it's been positive. I'm not saying, you know, they're going to give you a job or anything that. But, you know, they're really investing time in me, which, you know, I think is great. And I just think it's about getting as much experience as possible. When you're a young coach coming through, as much experience, so the age group stuff's great, because, you know, if you can learn to deal on a personable level and understand what motivates people, how to get the best out of them, you know, the younger generation, if you like, then that gives you a great transferability into sort of, you know, senior rugby. But it's the same thing, isn't it? You know, the RFU don't run the club game.
Yeah.
You know, where's the player debate we have about whether they rest and time off and all that sort of stuff, and who's paying who. So you speak about Exeter, of course, you know, they're looking after their own entity because they're not getting any real help from outside. And actually, that's all they've got to focus on, you know, bringing these people through, having that succession plan. Clubs are responsible, you know, if they want to take the baton, they've got to be responsible for that ultimately, instead of sort of, jumping over hurdles.
Alex, what do you think? The history of, as Nick says, finding a foreign accent. When a club needs a new DOR, can you see that changing? Is there really any real reason why we don't trust the English coaches enough?
I don't see it changing. I mean, just this morning, Scarlets have replaced Wayne Pivac with...
Go on, pronounce it. I was going to have a crack at that.
Brad Moore?
Yeah.
It sounds like Brad it, doesn't Moore. It? There's a double OA in there. So,
double OA, which is unusual. Yeah, so they've turned to New Zealand.
So they've gone from one Kiwi to another.
To another. I spoke to Rory Best last weekend about Andy Farrell stepping up to take over Ireland. And his point was, he used a similar phrase to you, Nick. He said it's not about going out to find people with crazy accents, as he put it. Although I'm not sure Andy Farrell's accent is particularly Dublin. But his point was that Andy's been there as part of the setup and has come through. He understands what has been successful, but then he can bring a fresh perspective and a new voice to it. But he's embedded in the system, and I think you're right. I don't see the knee jerk of looking abroad changing, because it's that whole cycle of how do you gain experience without having the experience, and the shortcut seems to be, well, look what the assistant coach at the Crusaders is doing, and almost value that more. What Ben was just saying about the England age group setup not kind of aligning all the way to the top. When I spoke to Dean, his explanation for getting rid of Fletcher Walton and Russell Earnshaw was because their perspective on coaching under-18s didn't marry up with what he wanted at under-20s. And he wanted a more, in his words, more streamlined, upward-looking system. But then I asked him, how does it work for the under-20s?
You asked him, what does that mean?
Yeah. Well, yeah, it took a while to kind of shed away the management speak. And he basically wants a more streamlined system with fewer coaches, which also helps because the RFU are trying to save some money. But then, from under-20s upwards, Dean Ryan doesn't speak to Eddie Jones. He speaks to Steve Borthwick. So, back to where we were starting, Eddie Jones is, although it was technically his job description to bring through young coaches, he relies that there's a gap between the man at the very top and the rest of the structure.
When he brought John Mitchell in, do we know how many other people he spoke to?
Yeah.
You know, did he speak to Alex Anderson at Saracens? And, you know,
well, we know he went to Andy Farrell first. We know that.
There's a few people that he talked to, and I think, you know, so yeah, you, you, we might be having a conversation differently if one of those had accepted his attack job or his defence job. Or
but is that not a key issue? That if I mean, the word is he did speak to Alex Anderson. I don't know that as a fact, but the word is that he did. And if Alex would rather stay in a club setup that's really effective and developing all the other coaches there, then move to England. That says a lot, doesn't it?
It does, but it's a little bit similar to what used to happen in English football, where if you're a Premiership head. Of Premiership manager, you don't want to take the England job. But why? Suddenly, you don't play. You're not as on the ground as much. You're getting far more stress in the tabloids. You haven't got the week to week. You haven't got the. So, and in rugby terms, if you want to grab one of the top DORs to take over from Eddie, you have to do a good selling job of it.
And Mark McCall's already said about a year ago, exactly that. Why would he leave a system that's running and purring and
I'm interested in this. I'm sort of aware that this is sort of a conversation or that people might be thinking about. But you two Ben, you just said it. Nick, you just sort of nodded as if it wasn't even a talking point that being with a club should be in many ways deemed more fulfilling than being in the England thing. Like when Paul Gustard moved away from England to Harlequins, it was like, hang on a sec, you were with the absolutely ultimate at the peak of the coaching world, and you've gone to a club, but you don't think that's remotely surprising?
I don't think it's surprising. No, Ben's alluded to it. The day to day thing's big. When you're coaching internationally, you've got them 5 weeks. End of October, November. Then you don't see them again for 8 weeks. You get them in the Six Nations, and you don't see them again for 2 months. And then you've got a sort of 3 week tour, and then there's a big gap in the summer and everything. And as a coach, like any sort of job, you want to be doing that job. I mean, it's a wonderful job, and you clearly to do it, you're very, very passionate and motivated by it. And so that's from a work perspective. The other thing is, as he rightly says, is the pressure on you. We used to say sometimes we were playing international rugby, there's no next week. Whereas in club rugby, you slip up. Yeah, look, there is pressure on you, but there's another game the next week, there's another game the next week, there's another game the next week to get back on the horse. International rugby, there is that pressure, and that's what you like, that's what you thrive, that's what you, when you were playing the game, that's where you wanted to play, against the best in the world on the biggest stages. But in this country particularly, if you're not getting the results, and that's what it comes down to, if you're not getting the results, it can be pretty horrible experience and existence.
Ben, can I just, Alex mentioned Andy Farrell, we talked about Andy Farrell.
Yeah.
Just a sort of a final point on this whole coaching conversation and English coaches and why do they not get elevated, etc. So we got to this weird situation where you had Stuart Lancaster and Andy Farrell running England, and as we all know what happened, they lost their job after the World Cup. And you're in that squad, Nick, so maybe I'll ask you, maybe you don't want to comment, I don't know. But how has the RFU or England, I mean, the media said that Stuart Lancaster should lose his job as well, so we can't say that we're any wiser, but we've allowed this situation to happen where those two coaches have both gone to Ireland, slung out of the English system and made astonishing successes of themselves, and now we're all going, can we get them back? Well, we can't. Farrell, we're never going to get back. We're not going to get out for 4 years at least, because he's got the Ireland job coming to him, and Lancaster's won a Heineken Cup with Leinster.
Yeah, but I think we talked about it. Alex mentioned it, what Eddie said, and you don't always make everything a success, and so Stuart ultimately was let go based upon the hard and fast results in the World Cup, and he was the top man, and as a result had to go. And there are so many stories of coaches. I left England Sevens, although World Cup final was our last tournament, we had a pretty shoddy last season. And so many people could deem that a failure. And then you go and, you learn from things and reinvent and press a reset button and you get better. And that's kind of your coaching journey. I don't think there's many coaches out there that have just had complete success from day one and carried on through. So
do you think England maybe got the timing wrong in that respect? So if those two had done their years in Ireland and then come into England, but with four more years or three more years, would they have then be the more finished article? Or?
All I know is that a couple of things turn around when you go to international rugby. You spend inordinate amount of time in front of media and doing all of that stuff, way more than that's the job of coaching, and you're not actually coaching day to day. And so you can get a bit rusty, and you can overthink because you've got these massive pockets of just inactivity. And I remember Brian Ashton, when he was coaching, he's the only coach I know that he'd come down to Newbury and coach with me, because he said he got rusty as England coach because he had so much time. And that's someone that cares about his art, you know, his coaching art, and wants to do that. I've not heard of any England coaches in the last 10 years going, well, I need to keep my coaching going. Stuart actually tried his best at, you know, and doing some age group stuff in Leeds and things like that. But yeah, so there's a lot of nuances with stepping up, I think, from club to international.
Let's move on. This is The Ruck. We'll be back in a minute.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome back to The Ruck. Following the end of the Autumn Internationals, we're back on back at the Premiership this weekend. The Premiership has an extraordinary shape at the moment. Saracens are next to... just motoring away from the rest of the bunch, leaving them in their wake. The Gallagher Premiership has become a weird two-tier tournament with Saracens and Exeter at the top and the rest of them really all still just about in danger of relegation. Gloucester in third and they're closer in points to Newcastle in 12th than they are to top-place Saracens. So, Ben, what do you make of what you've seen in terms of who might be succumbing to the pressure? And
It's so hard to call. It's a bit like a game... football championship top 12 places, you know, there's nothing to separate them, and you know, a couple of good wins we'll see Newcastle and Sale leap up into mid-table. I actually looking at this and going, if there's one, you know, looking at the power, the increasing power of the clubs now, and if one of those big boys is still down there in the next couple of months, I honestly think, and he will be talking about ring fencing in the next 6 months, you'll be having show after show talking about ring fencing.
Can I just interrupt you? Because this is one thing I wanted to discuss today, and it's going to be my story in the Times tomorrow. That what you've just said is completely back on. The clubs are talking about ring fencing right now.
Yeah, I think you just got to look one step ahead, Owen.
But there are clubs now. So they've been talking about it in recent weeks. There are clubs now who want to have the fence brought down at the end of this season. So there will be no relegation.
Yeah,
and I think that will be impossible to pull off because it'll be I don't know if legally you could change the rules in the middle of the season.
I bet they could.
There's a big push to do that, to turn it into a 13-team Premiership because the only reason they didn't get ring fencing through before was because they couldn't work out what to do with the 13th team. Mm-hmm. Now they're going to get all this money from the CVC deal, which is going to go through next week, and all of a sudden 13 dividing by 13 doesn't seem quite such a bad thing anymore. So that's part of the conversation. It's interesting that for me I've been. Not so anti ring fencing at all in the last couple of seasons, because the relegation battle, people say, oh, but the relegation battle is important. But in recent years, the relegation battle has been almost irrelevant because the relegated club has made itself obvious before Christmas, really. There's never been any drama. But finally, this year, as we're discussing, relegation is just, I mean, it's more interesting at the bottom than at the top, isn't it?
Well, yeah. There was when my first year at Harlequins, we got relegated. You know, 38 points, never been done before. You know, Mark Evans was a DOR then. He said, if we get to 37 points, we'll be all right, lads. We turned up with 37 points playing Sale at home on the last game of the season. And the first thing he said as a sort of motivational team meeting was, lads, 37 points isn't going to be doing it.
But that year, I was just looking up earlier, that year there were five teams within 5 points at the bottom.
Yeah.
So 38 points is the record.
And that was also 10 years ago.
I think also 2005. Yeah, yeah, this is I guess one of my points is that was 2005 7 years into professional rugby at that point, you know, and the game is still very young, and we're still evolving, and I think this is, whether people like it or not, it's going to happen. There'll be ring fencing because they're going to have to, because of the pressure on these clubs financially. They need a bit more. They need a bit more planning. They can't, you know, they can't have to have these knee-jerk reactions about going up, going down. That 13th club. I mean, the Championship. I'm not sure anyone knows what they're doing with the Championship.
Well, I think the Championship would benefit from being disconnected in some ways, because it's just a non-competition at the moment. When you know that the club that's going to win the Championship is the club that's just come down.
Yeah. And so, what is its value?
What do you think? Would you be a fan of cutting it off and?
I'm a fan of as it is now. However, the Championship plays a massive part in that, as you say. You know, if you haven't got clubs prepared to be sustainable going up, actually, what benefit long term are you getting out of this for the club and the development of the club? Because let's just look at the case. If there wasn't relegation, you know, what happens towards the end of the season? The sort of bottom six sides, what are they playing for? Or the bottom five sides, what are they playing for? You've got world class players at those clubs. They can blood a load of youngsters, but actually for the paying fan that's paying the wages of, you know, top Kiwi players, top Australian, top English internationals, but actually you're pulling them out to develop a load of players. They're getting shortchanged there as well.
But it would be interesting to know, if you were to come back here in a year's time, having coached in Super Rugby, as a coach, whether there isn't promotion relegation, whether that would have any impact on your view.
Well, you even look at Super Rugby. Who's interested in the games in the last sort of month of the season?
Correct.
You know, they used to. They don't this year because it's World Cup. It's shorter. But when they brought in that, you know, that month off, and then they came back and played three games into the playoff. Who was interested in those other games? Yeah. They're a bit of a free for all. They're sort of 50 points to 40. They meant nothing. Crowds dwindled. They didn't want to turn up. The season was over as far as that was concerned.
I think also though that we're not necessarily, like, we shouldn't put Super Rugby up here, a bit like we shouldn't necessarily put New Zealand Rugby up here. You know, there's a lot wrong with Super Rugby at the moment. You know, there's major issues on the new franchises, on the strength of the Australian franchises, on Twiggy, Forrester now setting up this alternative program that could end up usurping Super Rugby. So, you know, I don't think it's necessarily look at that and go, well, you know, we should be doing that. But it's the no relegation as far as allowing these clubs to breathe a little bit more in the Premiership to start to develop themselves. And I think there's nothing wrong with, if a club has got aspirations to play at the top level that is down, you know, that is, you know, the Exeters of tomorrow, there's nothing wrong with them moving up the Championship and showing that they've got then financial capabilities.
If you have a 13-team Premiership, then you're just ready and waiting for a 14th team to make itself available.
And a 15th and a 16th.
It isn't part of development, though, for players, teams, groups, dealing with pressure. Because what are you developing them for? World Cup semi-finals, you know, Lions deciding tests, whatever it is, you know, the pinnacle of the game. Isn't part of that development, have you got, you know, what's your mindset like? What's your clarity of thought? What's your skill level like? You know, dealing with those pressure moments. So you come to a game and actually, can you execute the skill? Is your decision-making under pressure as good as it can be? Whereas if you take that away, you know, I get both sides of the argument, but that is also part of development. It's not about, okay, there's no pressure. We can play as much as we can, get as many touches as we can. The ball's in play a lot longer because everyone's got the same philosophy. It's actually how you manage your way to win a game. Because aren't we developing them to get as far as they can? In which case, as far as they can at the moment, you know, World Cup final, British Lions tours, whatever it might be, is about winning. And that's the other side of the
coin. They'll still be trying to do that at the top end, won't they? They'll still be trying to get into playoffs and trying to win Premiership titles. And you could argue the ones down the bottom aren't going to be playing international rugby anyway. If they're not good enough, if they're playing in a team that's losing every week and that's fighting down the bottom. I don't know. I mean, I just look at the wider picture as well and go, they'll allow more English youngsters to be playing more regularly, to play in the Premiership. That will then, the clubs will be a bit more flexible about releasing players for international duty, age groups as well.
If I was the RFU, and I believe I'm right, they have the final sign off.
Yeah.
Is that if they were to agree to ring fence the Premiership, I would force the clubs to ditch the Premiership Cup and strike much stronger relationships with the Championship.
The Premiership Cup's almost dead already.
But instead of stockpiling young players...
You should be organising this season. You've just done it.
Only playing them in Premiership Cup games and then they don't play again for 2 months. Those players should go to the Championship clubs and there should be a much much stronger relationship with those clubs, which is possibly more possible if there's no relegation.
We could
more
get A-League out of the way as well and then playing Championship and then that would increase the standard and you'll end up having almost like a NBA type thing where you've got, you know, the main NBA sides and they've got these teams underneath that play in a secondary league and they can bounce up and down more freely and those things will again... All these can bounce out of that.
The important thing when you're doing that is, as part of the Quinn's coach stuff, we have these conversations every now and again outside the senior stuff about the A-League, you know, the debate about the A-League and whether on loan to a Championship club or, you know, part of another club, is clearly the big factor in that is obviously training times, when they come back and train with you, the calls, you know, style of play. So if you did have, like you say, the NBA, and it's a bit easier in basketball because it's five players on the field and...
Yeah.
On the court and everything like this, and pretty much, you know, everyone plays sort of similarly. But if you've got a different style, calls, philosophy, or demands of you as a player to be in a different position, whereas if they were married up, you know, that would be great. Yeah. That would be tremendous. But there's a lot of sort of organisation to be doing. And
okay, listen, what get through that. While we still have relegation, in theory at least, so let's do it then. Everyone's got to pick a club to be relegated at the end of the season. Let's start with you, Alex.
Well, pre-season I said Worcester on record points, and I might as well stick with that. Worcester on record points.
I'm going to go with, well, they're all pretty much big dogs, but I'm going to go with Leicester for the reason I said. Reason I said before. I mean, if any side's going to be under pressure internally.
Yeah,
and from, you know, historically and from their own public, it's going to be them. And you know, watching them, you know, I'm not talking about what happened at the weekend because we know that's pretty dire, despite having a man sent off. But you know, I haven't been convinced about them turning the corner yet. They're a great club. Sad to say it. It'd be sad, you know, for any of these clubs to go down. But I'm going to stick my neck out and go for a big one.
Ben,
I'm probably with Alex. Worcester, I think, are gonna. I think they haven't been hit too badly by injuries, but they haven't got that much depth. So I think that they'll, in a month's time, we might see them at the foot of the table, and they might be fighting out with. They're much better at home than away, but Sale haven't really thrown too many punches this season to show that they're better than perhaps they should be with the budget that they've got.
I think Sale will get better. The two Dupere brothers that you mentioned, Nick, they seem to... Well,
said that for a while, though, didn't we?
What?
About Sale.
No, but, well, they got those two who have just arrived. James O'Connor's only played a few games.
Chris Ashton's only just come
Chris back. Ashton hasn't really played yet. So I kind of feel that they've
don't
got some
that
reinforcements.
I mean, I'm just throwing... I'm being a bit militant, but Sale get that. We get that a lot with Sale. Oh, this guy's just come back and then he's gone again and this someone's come back and they don't seem to be able to keep their main guys in the team for without suffering injury or drops in form. I'd be asking questions about Sale off the field because there's been no consistency of performance.
I think
there's
plenty of questions to ask about Sale and the way it's run off the field, on the field or
but
whatever.
It transfers.
I can't quite
it
see
transfers.
A Steve Diamond team going down, but... maybe I'm just maybe that was totally nonsensical to say that.
No, but I think at the beginning of the season, that would not have been something they would have. You know, if you said, "Well, Sale are going to, you know, come second bottom in the Premiership," that's not something that they would have wanted to aspire towards. Them. Yeah. You know,
I would like to rewind to our first pre-Premiership podcast when we were talking about who's going up and who was going to win, who was going to struggle, and I said Sale were going to struggle, and Steve Jones just scoffed at me for my ignorance. So just this week, I'm looking smart. Professional Rugby at the top moves on to Europe this week. Massive weekend of games. The first round of the home and aways. English clubs haven't quite stamped their authority on it yet, that's for sure, but Newcastle are flying the flag. I'm just going to run through the fixtures. Scarlets, Ulster and Edinburgh, Newcastle on the Friday. On the Saturday, Exeter, Gloucester, which is a massive game. Exeter still talking about performing in Europe and not quite doing it yet. Then Lyon Glasgow on the Saturday, Bath Leinster. That doesn't look like a happy fixture for Bath. Toulon Montpellier, Wasps Toulouse, Wasps struggling. And then on the Sunday, Munster Castres. Saracens should beat Cardiff at home and improve their position. And Racing at home against Leicester. Leicester, I don't think they really needed Racing away at this point of their season. But if they got a result, then maybe they could turn their season around with a strong European campaign. Because let's face it, they're not going to be doing anything else at the other end of in the Premiership, are they?
It's interesting this weekend. If you take the Bath Leinster game, you could potentially, if you fancy a little flutter, you've got a 9-game home accumulator there. You look at those other fixtures, and there's every chance that the home teams are gonna win. Toulouse have put on a bit of form recently, but not a huge amount, and Wasps need to bounce back. Munster are going to be too strong, I would imagine, for Cast and Saris and Racing. And then Lyon are fourth in the top 14 at the moment. Glasgow, I think, are second in their competition in the Pro 12.
So that's our betting expert you are now, Ben.
I am not a betting expert.
No, you are. Talking about a 9-game accumulator.
Well, there you go. Stick a fiver on that and see what happens. Because Edinburgh Newcastle is interesting. They are probably Viliami Mata, who's, you know, I know him pretty well, the number 8 at Edinburgh, who's playing brilliantly, got injured in the France game. For Fiji, so I don't know if he's playing because he's been there.
I spoke to Dean Richards last week, actually, just on the phone, and that's all he spoke. We're talking about that game, and that's who he spoke about.
Stop Bill.
He was saying, God, you know, he's got this, he's got that, he's got everything. You know, we're going to have to stop him if we're going to have any chance.
Yeah.
And of course, that's just down the road for them, isn't it? It's much closer than any Premiership club.
Yeah. They're going to have. It's all about. Bill has been the leading points, carries everything off the whole lot.
That's what he's known as, Bill, is it?
Yeah, Bill. Viliami is Bill. So Bill Mata, So if he's not playing, and there's every. He didn't play last weekend. That could be, advantage Newcastle. But that's an interesting one, that one, because I think if Edinburgh lose that one, then they'll probably change their troops the following week and concentrate on domestic stuff.
Okay, thanks, gents. Our final item of the podcast, regular, is our God or Goddess of the Week. Someone who's impressed you on or off the pitch, something related to rugby. That's generally how it works. Ben?
Well, I spent an hour here and I haven't even talked about sevens, so I've got to throw in Dan Norton. He scored 300 tries in the World Series at the weekend.
Not in the weekend, though.
That would be too much even for him. His dad was also, maybe we could stick him as a god, because he had a St. George flag with Dan Norton as the founder member of the 300 club there as he was drinking his way through Dubai.
Is he the first
weekend.
Ever English sevens player to score 300?
Oh, no one in the world has got anywhere near that.
First,
I mean,
in the world.
He's 40 right. clear of anyone. That record is not going to get touched. You know, the next one closest is St Atla probably, or someone like that, and they're playing Super Rugby. And, you know, Ben Gollings was the highest in England, and that he was on 220, so he's 80 clear of that.
Wow.
He's had an amazing season.
How many more years has he got, Dan?
He's only 30, so he's looking after himself. He's got beefed up as well from his early skinnier days. That would be my god.
Very good.
I call Dan Norton a god, but there you go.
I think it's uplifting rather than sombre, but sticking with South African theme, actually, and finding out this morning that Nuka Dropski, who got shot over the weekend, you know, protecting his family in armed robbery, on his brother's house, and I think he's all good in the hospital, he's in a stable condition. You know,
because that was a concern, wasn't it? It was touch and go either way.
Yeah, and to survive something like that, you can be called a god. Let's hope he continues, the level of improvement that he's had as well. You know, there's no setbacks, but obviously wishing him well, the whole of the rugby world. But, not a nice story, but uplifting at the fact that, he seems to be in good,
very
stable
good.
Condition at the moment.
Very good. Alex?
On the field, the best game I saw the weekend was Harlequins. Best performance, I thought, was Harlequins. I thought they were... Paul Gustard has got them motoring now, I think, and... Two players in particular, Alex Donbrandt, who John Kingston afterwards compared to Nick Easter straight out of university.
Is that a compliment?
Is that when he had his top off?
I think that's when Paul Gustav said he still has a rig of a player from university. But actually, Mike Brown, because we spent a lot of the autumn talking about Elliot Daly, and he hasn't quite nailed down the fullback shirt. And I was saying that the door cannot be closed on Mike Brown to go to the World Cup, because as Eddie tries all these other players, he just still looks to be the most reliable, solid, that sounds disrespectful, but like most suited for that role in this England team. And I thought, even with his new haircut, he looked like a new man.
He's just grown it.
I just thought he played really well, and it was a very timely performance to send a message back to Eddie Jones.
Mm. Nick, just on that, would you have Mike as your... Would you bring him back into the England team?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, the guy's the ultimate competitor. He's done it before for England, and Eddie knows you need caps as well. You know, I think he was just, experimenting. He was trying a few things out, I think, as well.
Yeah.
And you've seen by Mike's performance how he's responded to not being involved. He's an angry man, that's his nickname.
But he must be furious now.
First game of the Six Nations. Ireland away. Who do you want at fullback?
Mike Brown.
You know, under those Sexton bombs.
I can't believe that I'm saying this, given how much I've been saying that England should change their 15. But I would now say Mike Brown or Alex Good.
Same. I'd be sticking Elliot Daly at 13 and stop messing around with playing him at fullback.
Okay. Thank you very much, gents. I now have to declare who is the God of the Week, and it's impossible to separate that lot because there was three very different and deserving candidates, so we can have three gods of the week. Ben, Nick and Alex, thank you very much indeed. The Ruck will be back next week following the European weekend. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you back next week.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.